course, you also notice that the effect of the Roman Empire was to wipe out 1,000 years, you know, to set humanity back 1,000 years, literally, you know, because in 600 AD, we're back at the population level in the Roman world that we were at around 400 or 350 BC. Nice guys, those Romans. Now, here's this is kind of interesting. You got the life expectancy and probably duration of life in the Roman Empire. And, so you'll notice on this column that kind of the further away from Rome you are, the better off you are. So the duration, you know, you get the idea of the duration of life. Or you can compare it to, you know, what you had in India under the British Empire, for example. North Africa is significantly higher because this is one of the breadbaskets of the Mediterranean world at the time. So you had a much higher levels of production, more fertile soil and everything. So there was you had a better quality of life, where Rome was pretty brutal. The Punic Wars ran for a long time, from 264 BC until 201 BC. I don't know at what point these numbers were taken, but one thing that is the case, as we'll get to, in Rome, is that the what would change these numbers, well, not like 1,000 years, nothing actually changed in Rome, technologically, agriculturally, or anything like that. But we'll get to that and the implications of that. Now, this is curious also, because here you have population density. We took these numbers from surveys and research that's been done over the years, and compiled this to use kind of some of LaRouche's methods of approximating population density potential. So now, Greece, okay, 400 BC, this is at the tail end of the height of Greek civilization, the golden age of Greece. And you had 3 million Greeks, and you had 23 per square kilometer. That's their potential might have been higher than that, but that's how many they were supporting at the time, okay? Italy at the time was 13.3. Now you see between 1000 BC and 400 BC, 600 years, Greece has increased by a factor of 3 the number of people it can support. And then 200 BC, it's declining. AD, it's declining, declining, declining. And AD 600, you've got a little bit over 6 people per square kilometer. So a 75% collapse in Greece under the Roman Empire. Now, the collapse, In Italy, it increases, right? But in AD 200, you've got 23 people per square kilometer in Italy. And then by AD 600, you've got 11.6 people per square kilometer. Now, if you've done some economics, you understand, especially the Russo's economics, what it is that causes the increase in population per square kilometer and what causes it to collapse. You know, so when you're looking at this kind of stuff, think about the times that we're in and what's going on. So, all right, now under Rome, I had some interesting little details on this to give you an idea about what we're talking about here. Now, Edward Gibbon, who wrote The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, who had been commissioned by Lord Shelburne of the British East India Company, you know, we know him pretty well. He wrote, I quote, that the Pax Romana was, quote, the period in the history of the world during which the condition of the human race was most happy and prosperous. Okay. And that's, and when he talks about the Pax Romana, he's talking about that period up to 200. This is considered the period from about 1 AD to 200, roughly, is considered the Pax Romana, the Roman peace, right, when the world was all at peace and everything was nice and people got along. Not quite, but that's the way they portray it. Okay, now, but what was Rome all about? Because we got to explain why this collapse happened, the internal collapse of this empire. Well, for almost 1,000 years, there was no cultural, scientific, technological, or productive advancement employed. And not only that, but when a discovery was made, the Romans wouldn't implement it. Anything any technologies they employed, they had taken from other cultures. Right, so they made no advancements in 1,000 years.
Even their gods,
yeah, were degenerate and taken from other cultures.
What about their infrastructure? I mean,
their aqueducts and stuff like
that. The roads.
They were builders, not thinkers. Well, here's the interesting thing: the roads were not designed to move goods, and they never did.
Where are we?
It was cheaper to transport produce from Alexandria to Rome than it was to move a cartload of the same amount of merchandise 75 miles outside of Rome. So nobody was trading on the roads. Besides, there wasn't much production going on, especially in Italy. So yeah, the roads were for the military, and that's it, really. But they didn't even have harnesses for their horses to be able to pull heavy loads for long distances. They refused to. Instead of developing better horse collars for doing more efficient agricultural labor, they would just figure out a way to use a bad version of a horse collar, which choked the horse, but figure out how to use it in such a way that the farmer knew when to stop just before the horse collapsed. Right? That's the Roman way. the Romans even knew about water wheels, and I think in the first century AD, they'd seen in one of the provinces you had a water wheel being used to turn a mill, which is grinding 3 tons of grain per hour, which is a lot. When at the time, using a donkey, walking around a wheel to pull and turn a grindstone was doing 10 pounds an hour. And the Romans wouldn't implement it, even though these were known technologies. So this is the Roman way. Okay, but yeah, it's true, they did have some big infrastructure. The biggest, two of the biggest, were the Colosseum and the Circus Maximus. The Colosseum, right, which dwarfs probably most of our stadiums. The Circus Maximus, at its biggest, held 255,000 people. The Colosseum, 50,000.
That's bigger than the Olympic Stadium.
Way bigger. Mm-hmm. It was 600 meters long, 200 meters wide, or something like that, the whole thing. Massive. This is just for chariot racing. Oh, yeah. Horse racing and stuff. We know what happened in the Colosseum. So these are the big infrastructure projects of Rome, right? The lasting contributions. Now, in 54 AD, how many days of the year would you guess were dedicated for festivals?
180.
Any other guesses?
159.
But yeah, but by AD 354, you had 200 official holidays. Okay.
This is just in Rome or all across the empire?
Well, this is in Rome specifically, but I'm sure that a lot of the other cities around the empire were trying to mimic that. They would build their own colosseums and circuses and things like that, and theaters. But well, since they were the ones that had to supply Rome with all the food and slaves and gladiators and animals to
party.
Yeah, well, they couldn't afford so much to party as the Romans, but Rome also had 1.2 million people. It was a massive city at the time. Okay. So
Bollywood in India.
And you get this huge entertainment complex industry coming out of India. The cell phone industry is exploding. But their quality of life is worse.
Yeah, right.
And it's worse now than when they started the boom.
So this is the kind of thing that you're working on, but at the same time, as you get there's absolutely no, and we can tell from archaeological research and stuff like that what the yield was, like what a Roman farmer could get off the land in say 400 or 500 BC and what he could get in 300 or 400 AD, things like that. No change. And yet the taxes kept going up all the time. As the land became depopulated, the response of the empire was to tax the remaining farmers more. Well, what does that do?
Accelerates
the decay. Yeah. So here's the thing. What is the in the end, you know, you can list all the problems, but what's the problem in the end? The one single problem that generates everything else? You know, what LaRouche calls the oligarchic principle. The problem was the entire society was organized on a false understanding of human nature. It was organized on the view that people were there to loot. The Roman Empire expanded by looting. That's what it did. When it stopped expanding, it started collapsing. Because what would happen? You'd conquer a new area, you'd loot it to death, you'd pull all of the wealth back to Rome, and this would kind of keep things moving. Like the Nazi war economy. Same thing. Right? They would take over France, they would move the industrial equipment back to Germany, they would wear that equipment out because they couldn't actually afford to put any industrial capacity towards building new machinery. So they would loot the country they just took over and then use that industrial potential that they'd looted to conquer another country, and that's how the Nazi economy was working until it ground to a halt in 44. It was the same thing that Rome was doing. So when it stopped cannibalizing and devouring the areas outside of it, it began devouring itself. Okay, and this is why, you know, in the end, every empire is doomed, why a world empire would be doomed, because it's doomed by its own internal contradictions. Because if it doesn't believe in development, at a certain point it's going to use up its resources. It's going to fail to be. It's not going to be able to reproduce itself any longer. Okay, and this is what really caused the doom of Rome. Rome was the doom of Rome. There's nothing external to it. It doomed itself. Okay, now.
Was there any people who? Set up the situation of having Rome being destroyed. Rome.
Well, I think it's like the oligarchy today. Or LaRouche references this this one turning point in I think it's 286 or 284 AD. You get a new emperor coming in named Diocletian, and Diocletian imposes what becomes known as the Diocletian Code. And this code. It's a law that basically says if you are a farmer, your son will be a farmer. If you're a cobbler, your son will be a cobbler. And they attempted to fix everybody in the job. Nothing will ever change again. Now, the thing is, why did they do that, right? Because Rome was becoming depopulated. The empire was being depopulated by itself. You know, there were different laws passed over the years to try to force people to have kids, to punish people who didn't marry or didn't have kids, things like this, but nothing really worked because the whole civilization was collapsing. It's like today. I mean, it's a big crisis in Canada, for example, that we're not reproducing ourselves as a society. You know, the birth rate of Canadian families is less than 2 per couple. So how are you going to reproduce yourself? It's a big problem. But it's not, you know, it's not because there's not enough wealth. It's because there's maybe the baby boomer phenomenon, right? Of pleasure before sacrifice or something. But But this is the kind of, but in a lot of cases, it's simply that families can't afford to have more kids. Because the society is not based on a principle of recognizing the value of human life. You know, if you see kids as being an expense on the society, a drain, instead of an investment in the future, then where's your society going to go? That's the problem right now. But that it's the same kind of thing, right? There's no understanding of the value of the creative output of the human mind. Now, just to give you an idea of what happens when the floodgates are unleashed around 410, you know, when you get the Visigoths, they invade Rome, and they sack Rome in 410, the city that had not been sacked or defeated since, 600 BC. Like 1,000 years, the city had not been touched. And it was pillaged in 410. And you can see all, you know, whether it's the... You get the Vandals who come in and they end up creating a kingdom down in here. You know, the Franks invade across the borders. The border of the Roman Empire at the time had been the Rhine River and the Danube, mostly. And all of these populations were being pushed eastwards, actually, by the Huns, which are one of the most barbaric groups at the time. So you had all these population pressures of groups looking to settle into the more, you know, civilized regions, that actually the depopulated regions of Europe at the time. And now I've got I pulled together a couple of maps. The point is not to spend a lot of time on these, but I want to give you an idea of the period between 400 and say I think the last one's 600. How profoundly Europe is transformed in a short period of time.
What year would this be? Those are all the dates.
Yeah, this shows the paths that the different these different Germanic tribes took.
The very end.
Hmm?
That's at the sort of the very end.
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, the first invasions start before the final collapse of Rome. The first one starts around in early 400. The last ones end. I think the last number up there is the Lombards coming down in 568. So they last for a long time. Because you got to think at the same time, as Rome is not, it's there, but it's not there. It's actually disintegrating around the shoulders of the Romans themselves. Administration is collapsing, cities are being looted, pillaged over and over again. So here's Europe. When Rome collapses, if you think back to that initial map, that this entire area was one color, was pink. Now you look in 476 when the last emperor is overthrown, and you have this guy Odoacer who puts himself in place. You got the Visigothic kingdom, you've got the Franks, you've got a bunch of different tribes up here. You got the Vandal kingdom, this Italian kingdom. I don't even know who that is there.
Ostrogoths.
You know, then you've got the Eastern Roman Empire. Okay, 50 years later.
One question.
Oh, and the Burgundians here. Hmm?
How do you figure the influence of different, let's say, cultural factors in the collapse? How do you fit them in the general time frame you just showed, the cultural things, for example, Christianity or the passing from the Republic into the Imperial Age, and then back to the Republic into the this constant struggle?
Well, I wouldn't even focus on a transition between Republic and Empire, because there's no real difference. It was just a matter of who really had the power, but it was an empire all along. The Christian thing we'll deal with in a moment, because it's an interesting one. Now, this is 50 years later. Okay, now you've got this Ostrogothic kingdom. The Franks are bigger, the Burgundians are still kind of there. The Visigoths have less. You got some new peoples over here. You know, this is in 50 years, the Vandals. Then in 75 years later, now it's different again. You've had this Emperor Justinian in the east who has launched this entire campaign. He wiped out the Vandals, reconquered certain parts of Italy. You know, the Franks are expanding, that kind of thing. And in 700, now you've got the Islamic empire being established. The Franks are larger.
The green is the Islamic empire.
Yeah. And all of those conquests of the East, gone. Italy's a bunch of small states.
What's the green term?
The green is the Islamic empire.
But I'm not Rome.
Well, Rome is here, but the Roman Empire is gone, that's the point. When the Roman Empire collapses, you get hundreds of years of just total war, pillaging, looting, conquest, kingdoms rise and fall again in a few years. Yeah, this is really the complete. And one of the key things is that the population of Europe continues to collapse until 600. Even though Western Empire falls or comes to an end in 476.
There's the gray remnant of the Eastern Roman Empire.
Yeah. This will continue until 1453.
But in effect, it started ending then too.
Yeah. It was declining the whole time. Okay. Yeah. So you get a sense now, if you can imagine for a moment, what life would have been like for people then. To say the least, not much time to read, not much time to study or educate yourself, think about the world, travel. You're just trying to stay alive, if you're lucky. Now, at this time, what's happening with Christianity? Because this is a very important point. Now, you have a very important figure. In fact, probably in Christianity, the second after Christ is the most important person, St. Augustine. Because without this guy, none of us are here today. Without this guy, Western civilization does not exist. Absolutely. Without question.
He had so many kids.
Ah, Valentin. Okay, but why? What's the issue with St. Augustine? Now, he had a couple friends, which I'm just going to point out to you now, and then I'm going to go back to Augustine. You had St. Ambrose, who's actually the guy who converted Augustine to Christianity. And you had St. Martin of Tours, who becomes important later. And I'll tell you why. One thing I wanted to point out, this picture here, because Augustine and Ambrose, these guys were spiritual warriors. These were Christians who, muscular Christians is Jerry... not Jerry Falwell. Jerry Rose once referred, you got some of these, wimpy Christians, but then you got these muscular Christians. And Ambrose, see, this is Ambrose here. Now, this scene probably didn't happen like this, but this is the Byzantine emperor, Theodosius. And Ambrose here is confronting him after Theodosius had ordered the execution of a bunch of people. And Ambrose threatens to excommunicate Theodosius. He says, man, you are one nasty sinner. And if you don't, you got to repent, this kind of thing. And they have this little fight. And Theodosius actually gives in to Ambrose. You're talking about the most powerful man in the world, Theodosius, at that time, at least in the Mediterranean world. And Ambrose, who's only a bishop in Milan, he's an important bishop, but he's a bishop. He doesn't command armies. And yet he fights this, he stands up to this guy, forces him to back down. But this is typical of what Augustine and Ambrose were doing. And it becomes important later also. Now, Augustine, what's the deal with Augustine? The books probably, the history books, and it was my sense of it, is that Christianity became officially adopted around 335 or something by the Roman Empire under Constantine, right, Emperor Constantine. But, well, yeah and no. Because although Christianity became the official religion, you had all of these different heresies floating around Arianism, Nestorianism. You had a bunch of different names of them. There's probably dozens of them. One of the important ones is Manichaeism, which is, it's kind of like what the world of the fundamentalists is today. You know, the flesh is evil, you know.
Dualism.
It's evil, you know. God's good, but the flesh is evil.
Yeah.
Isn't Manichaeism a perversion of Zoroastrianism?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, there's this duality, and, you know, God's up there, and it doesn't matter what you do in this life, because you're going to be saved, because the spirit is good, but the flesh is evil,
yeah.
And there's nothing you can do.
Great.
You know, and Augustine actually got into this for a long time. As a young man, he was a fiery guy, a lot of energy, looking for things to happen, and he got involved. He thought, hey, this is kind of cool, it means I can kind of let myself go and do whatever, and... I'll still be saved. But the thing was, the whole Christian world was being taken over by these heresies. And it was actually destroying Christianity, because there's no real difference between what these guys were saying and the pagan system. The different pagan beliefs and these different cult beliefs. Okay, so Augustine spent his life fighting these heresies, taking them on. And what he would do, he would go out and he would publicly debate the leading intellectuals of these different heresies. And often, like in the case of one of the leading Manichaeists, a guy named Faustus, he forced the guy capitulated, and then he converted to Catholicism. So he would do this, and this was, he was a real spiritual warrior his whole life. He was out there to fight, because what was key with Augustine and what turns him to Catholicism is actually Plato. Plato's a key shift in his life out of Manichaeism into a concept of a single God and a universe which is divinely and harmonically organized. And then when he realizes that the Gospels and this kind of thing, writings of Paul and so forth, are completely in accordance with Plato, and when he meets Ambrose, he tells Ambrose, you know, I've been reading Plato and I think this is quite interesting. And Ambrose says, oh, that's great. Well, Plato is pretty much a Christian. He just wasn't Jesus. And this is very important. Because without this concept of the filioque, which is that the human being is made in the image of God, which all of the different heresies denied. That was the problem. That was the thing about the heresies, and why they were so popular in an oligarchical system or world like you had with Rome. Because the population was bestialized, the concept of a human being being divine or capable of becoming divine or approaching it, for example, today, knowing God rationally as opposed to irrationally, that was completely foreign. And that's what really was a threat to the Roman Empire and the Roman system. Just like today, what the oligarchy hates the most is human beings that are creative and go out and tell others, hey, you're not a cow, buddy. Yeah, you're not a monkey. And then prove it to them. And Augustine would write all kinds of dialogues and things like this. But this is the key thing, because how do you preserve the classical world? Now, this is the problem that's confronting Augustine. And this is this is crucial, and it's something that Cahill misses. Why the Irish? Because St. Patrick, who Christianizes the Irish, is the nephew of St. Martin of Tours. Yeah. St. Martin of Tours is a follower of St. Ambrose. St. Ambrose is the guy who converts Augustine. Now, there's a lot of ambiguities about the dates exactly of Patrick's life. It's possible that he personally knew Ambrose and was taught by him. We're not sure. But what we do know about Patrick, and this is him here, that's one picture. we know that he taught the Trinity. That is, that you have a triune God. Or they say the Father, the Son, the Holy Spirit. But it's one divinity, it's not three. Now, at the time, Patrick lived from like 370 to... Well, it's different. Some people think he lived from 370 to like 490. That's a long time. Or 370 roughly to 380 until 460. So he's in this period. But the point is, at the time, apart from the odd pope, Augustine, Ambrose, and some of their small circle, the entire Christian world was dominated by the heresies, by all these different beliefs that, you know, man is a beast or this and that. There's different versions of it, but it all comes down to the same thing. It was all irrationalism. So now you've got Patrick going to Ireland to convert the Irish, preaching the Trinity and setting up monasteries that are modeled upon a work that Augustine had written called On the Monastic Life. Okay, so we're going to come to that in a minute. But again, think how must it have happened? Now, if you're Augustine, and he lived till 430, roughly, you're looking at the world around you, and you're seeing that the Roman world's going to hell. Now, St. Ambrose dies around 400, so he's not around for as long. He doesn't see Rome sacked, but Augustine does. And it would be pretty clear to Augustine that the end of this civilization is on the way. So what are you going to do? Because you know that if you don't save Christianity, if you don't save the classical tradition, everything's going to be lost. Because you see what these Germanic tribes are doing. They're destroying everything. Burning the libraries, all that kind of stuff. You see what Roman culture is like, and its cults, its hedonism, its orgies. You've been to the gladiatorial festivals, you know what's going on there. So what do? Get Christianity out. Get it out of Europe. Or get it out of the Roman world anyway. Now, because the thing is, what St. Patrick does, he goes to Ireland, which had never been colonized by the Romans. He's the first Christian missionary who's sent beyond the borders of the Roman world. Okay? So whenever you get these kinds of changes, you could say change in policy, right, or these kinds of leaps, you have to ask the question, why? Why now? Why not some other time? Why did he do this? Why was he sent on this mission? And when you put it in the context of the times, you know, and you're looking at Augustine, for example, who fought his whole life, you know, these guys around him, they were fighting tooth and nail just to save this discovery they had made in the nature of man. Say, get it out. We've got to go somewhere fresh. We've got to give a fresh start to this idea where it can be safe from the hell that's descending upon the Mediterranean world right now. So Patrick is the guy that's given this mission. Now, who is Patrick? Now, here, you know, it has nothing to do with drinking beer. Nothing to do with drinking beer.
Wasn't he the saint of all drunken people?
Well, you know, I'd like to know how that came about, actually, because it seems really...
It's the British. It's another...
Yeah, probably.
They also came out with, if it wasn't for booze, the Irish would rule the world. I don't think the Irish actually wanted to rule the world.
Well, no.
Are you Irish?
No.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's what the British came up with. Because they tend to see people as in their own mold.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's an unfortunate thing, but hopefully in time we can restore St. Paddy's Day to something better. Yeah, exactly. This is a different picture. This is Patrick talking with one of the kings of Ireland and the shamrock. And you know, there's different legends that he used the shamrock to explain the Trinity and stuff like that. Like from one stem, you get the three.
Oh.
So this triune relationship. But now what's interesting about Patrick is he was a Briton. He was from Britain. He was a Roman citizen. But when he was young, like 16 years old, he was captured by Irish raiders, and he was enslaved. And he spent 6 years freezing his ass off on a hillside in Ireland, tending sheep. Alone most of the time, freezing most of the time, hungry most of the time. And yeah, there's different stories about what happens. He started to pray a lot, and he kind of makes this breakthrough at a certain point, and he tells he has this dream of you know, this voice comes to him and says, Patrick, it's time to leave. It's time to go home. Your ship is waiting for you. And then he travels, so he gets up and he starts to leave, and he walks 200 miles to the coast, and he comes to this, I can't remember the name of the town, but he comes to this little town, and there's a ship that's loading Irish wolfhounds to be taken to Europe and stuff like that. And he manages to get his, you know, to convince the sailors to take him on board, and he gets out. And he's sure that this is a miracle, because he doesn't know how else he could have gotten so far as an escaped slave, how he could have evaded his captors and his king and stuff like this. But anyway, so he escapes, and he goes to Tours. Now, this is the interesting thing, right? He goes to Tours, where his uncle, who at this time is dead, but this is where his, you know, his family is. And he becomes ordained as a bishop eventually, but he's educated in Tours and Milan and these other centers of Augustinian influence. Right, so he's reading Augustine, he's reading all of this stuff, and he's involved in these networks. And at a certain point, he's deployed by Pope Leo I, who is in this Augustinian tradition, to go to Ireland. Now, at the time, for sure, Augustine would have been involved in this, because he was the most important man of his age. You know, and this is around the time that Augustine would have been nearing his death in 430, but that's the... So there's a lot that we don't know about how it happened, but there's certain important things that we do know, you know, about what Patrick's beliefs were, the networks that he would have been working in, and the fact that for some grip... Like, again, like I said before, it's only great deeds are only done for great causes. So now, with our friend Patrick. There's something funny, because the Irish were not, I mean, you're talking of all the peoples that you're going to go out and convert. You're going to go convert the Irish, I mean. At the time, you got to understand, these people were total barbarians. I mean, they were one of the most barbaric peoples in all of Europe. I mean, they were still practicing human sacrifice. You know, after wars, one of their favorite things they would do is they would cut off the heads of their enemies and then wear them on their belts. This kind of stuff. And
original.
Yeah,
all kinds of stuff. But you have... and they'd post them on the walls there, you know... forts and stuff like that. But this Irish culture is very... Cahill is interesting, the way he approaches it. He looks at the literature. Ancient Irish literature. Yeah. And what do their myths tell about the way the people thought? Because that, in a sense, the myths are like a version of the dreams, the collective dreams of the people that you're studying. And... the dreams are filled with these, you know, larger than life characters. You know, this one kid, Cahulain. He's a 16-year-old kid, and you know, he takes on this army of, you know, thousands of people. And you know, just before battle, he goes through what the Irish call the warp spasm. And Cahill quotes from a section of this story called the Táin, and describing this warp spasm. It's like, you imagine, you know, this little kid turning into this giant ravenous beast, you know, his eyes are doing all kinds of stuff, you know, his whole body's contorting into, you know, all kinds of wild stuff. I mean, it goes on for a long time, you know, and you wonder how, you know, every body part's doing something different. And, you know, and anyway, then he starts smiting the enemy, and he's, you know, cutting them down left, right, and center, and he's killing thousands of people, and he doesn't even get a scratch and this kind of thing, right? You know, this kind of, or you think about the stories of Hercules or these kinds of things, doing all these wild things and totally beyond belief. But the Irish love that, but at the same time, what does it tell them it tells you something about what they fear, right? That in fact, their lives were dominated by superstition, by fears of death, and you know, for them, you lived for the moment. You know, you went into battle. You went into battle naked, screaming. Right? You wore a little golden hoop around your neck. You wore sandals. You had your sword, your shield. And that was about it. And they would go through this warp spasm, which is actually something they would work themselves up into this frenzy, and go into battle that way. And you know, in these myths, they would tell about. Tells the night before this battle with Cahoon, the enemy army, you know, the men can't sleep, they're, you know, the goddess of war is visiting them, and they're all freaked out, and, you know, there's a breath of wind goes by, and 100 people die, you know, they're so terrified, this kind of thing, you know, and it's, eventually the queen of this army comes by, and her name actually means mead, you know, or like drink. But she calms them down, and you know, what was typical is these warriors that would go to bed drunk, you know, because that's how you got over your fears. You drank, or you worked yourself into a frenzy. So you can imagine the kind of world that these people lived in, right? There was spirits behind every corner, at every crossroads. There was some demon that might be there and trick you, that kind of thing. So a world that was fundamentally irrational. Not exactly the kind of terrain that you send a, like. I don't know. Patrick might have been in his. He would have been maybe in his 40s at this point, late 30s, early 40s. Right. So you send him by himself, maybe with like one retainer, into this jungle. Yeah, into this middle of this war zone. You know, and the favorite thing that the Irish had to do was fight. That was their favorite thing. But what he does, see, because he was a slave, he'd grown up in this, he'd learned the Irish vernacular. And what he does is he takes these myths and he takes the pagan virtues that the Irish had of courage, loyalty, and generosity, and he turns them into, he kind of reworks the stories, reworks the concepts, into and he turns these three into the Christian virtues of faith, hope, and charity. So the idea is like, hey, you were already Christian, but you just didn't know it.
Which is cool.
But within 100 years, all of Ireland is converted, like 250 to 300,000 people. So Patrick was a busy guy, you know. And he, but there's a couple funny stories about him. Like there's this one a place that's called what's the name? It's a funny account I got from his biography. You know, during his evangelizing, he's understood to have carried with him an ash wood walking stick or staff. I think this one right here. He thrust this stick into the ground wherever he was evangelizing, and at the place now known as Espatria, Ash of Patrick. The message of the good news took so long to get through to the people there that the stick had taken root by the time he was ready to move on. You know, so there's these kinds of stories of this. You know, one, if he went to a council where all the chieftains, and because the Irish also like larger-than-life stories, and so they would take these stories of what Patrick actually did, you know, and they did that with all their major saints. So Patrick has to, but if he has to confront the Druids, because this is the main priesthood at the time. And he does this at this one convention where all the chieftains and the kings have gotten together. And so the Druids, they're working their black magic, and they summon this big cloud and of darkness, you know, that covers the land. And then Patrick says, okay, remove it now. Show your power, remove the cloud. And they're trying their incantations, and they can't. Then Patrick gets down and he prays, and the sun comes and, you know, blows away the cloud. And then the archdruid gets up and he starts doing his incantations and he levitates himself up into the sky. And Patrick gets down on his knees and prays, and the spell of the druid is broken. And he, you know, falls crashing to the ground and dies. And then everybody's converted because they say, well, holy shit, this god's pretty powerful. So we better get on his side. And so the druids are broken, this kind of thing. You know. But the, so this is the, but he goes around and he's setting up monasteries and he's setting up churches and this kind of thing, but what does he really do? what he brings, the concept he brings is of a universe that is not superstitious. You know, because a good question to ask is why would the Irish accept what Patrick's offering? You know, why? What is it that would totally revolutionize the society in less than 100 years? It's really that Patrick gives them their humanity. And we know from archaeology that the gods, the Irish gods, any statues they had of them, they were really monstrous beasts. You know, things that you would fear. You didn't love these gods. They were out to get you. You know, they were not your friends. So what he shows is that, in fact, no. This universe is knowable. You know, and there's a creator there that actually loves his creation. And he's not out to get you. And there's a famous poem called Patrick's Breastplate, which is like it's a prayer. I'm not going to read it or anything, but there's an interesting few sections that refer to approaching crossroads, and Christ has already gone before. And it's like he's cleared out the demons. He's cleared the path for you. You know, he's cleared the land of the evil spirits that were haunting us and making us fearful. You know, and he's now brought a world that is knowable, that is friendly. You know, the world is no longer a place to be afraid of. I think this is a very important point, you know, even when you look at the culture today, also, you know, the kind of world that people think they live in out there, unknowable or unchangeable, beyond the power of control or understanding of the individual, fundamentally irrational. Mm-hmm.
How long did he stay in Rome he went to?
He was there maybe 10 or 15 years.
You say it was Tours?
Maybe 20. He was in Tours, he was in Milan, he was in a few other places around in France and Italy. But again, there's a lot of debate over his life and different things, you know, dating and things like that.
St. Augustine was mainly based where?
He was. He spent time in Rome, Milan, and then finally in Hippo, in northern, near Carthage, in northern North Africa,
okay.
Or modern Tunis,
Tunisia.
Yeah. He was a bishop, eventually.
This is really interesting. This idea of superstitious world,
mm-hmm.
And you've added the idea of being an unchanging world, static world.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, a sense of powerlessness among the people to
mm-hmm.
affect change in any knowable way.
Yeah.
I mean, it reminds me of confronting someone on the street with the idea of empire and what do you do?
Mm-hmm.
And people saying, oh man, they've got everything under complete control. It's impossible.
Mm-hmm.
It'll never, it's always been that way. It's always the way it's going to be.
Yeah.
It sounds like the same world.
Yeah, for sure. That's just it. And probably Irish society had not changed for hundreds and hundreds of years. You know, in a sense, it was a fixed society. But of course, you know, societies are like that, right? Unless you have the intervention of new ideas. And this again goes back one of the principles of universal history and history as a whole. That with the collapse of the Roman Empire, you see how this collapse keeps going until 600. And it would have kept going. There is no necessary reason for the Roman Empire to stop collapsing, or Western civilization to stop collapsing. There's nothing that said, okay, well, it was going to turn itself around. You know, they were down for a few weeks, you know, had a few bad games. He's back. You know, they're back now. Yeah, made a few trades, brought in a pinch hitter. Nothing that would say that. Because the fundamental principles which the society was based on were flawed. You know, and it's like that today. What do we, you know, this society will keep collapsing unless there's the introduction of a new principle or a new idea, which overcomes the false ideas that were dominating before. You know, what actually is going to stop the collapse of Western civilization is when the Irish reintroduce Christianity and learning.
So they were the only people who believed in Christianity?
Yeah, they were the only Christians, yeah, in Ireland. All the rest were you know, under... But actually, in fact, a lot of Europe reverted to paganism under the Germanic invasions. You know, apart from becoming, much of France was no longer inhabited, these kinds of things. You know, so this was not just, you know, you had a bunch of Christians around and they were just, you know, waiting for the books to come back. But the Christians were disappearing. So, okay. So you got, now, this, the little green things, those are monasteries. And this is probably within 100, 150 years of Patrick arriving in Ireland. It's a lot of monasteries. Now, what's interesting is that the you had no real towns or city urban centers in Ireland before Patrick came. You had small villages, you had most people, it was just rural, things like this. Maybe little villages or hamlets along the coasts and along the rivers, but nothing else really going on. And what Patrick would do, he would go when they would set up monasteries, and then people that came after him, they would go out into the wilderness, and they would reclaim the wilderness. You know, they would set down their monastery, they would build some huts, some stone huts, build a church, you know, a couple of the buildings, and they would start to farm. Because the thing was with the Augustinian monastic doctrine, it was faith and works, and you worked, buddy, and even the abbot of the monastery worked. Everybody worked. And the Irish monasteries were unique in all of Europe because they were the only ones that didn't live off of the tithes or rent from the serfs around. Instead, here, these monasteries were the educational centers. And you had people coming from all over Europe eventually to get educated, first from Britain and in Scotland. They were coming from all over the place to get educated, free education, okay, for anybody who wanted it, equivalent of a university education today. Actually, better. You got a better education then. Pardon? No tuition. That's right. All you had to do was work. And but the thing was, you worked the land and you learned how to farm. They were using water. They had the most advanced farming techniques in Europe. They were actually running major diversionary projects for rivers. You know, they were using the water wheel. They were creating, you know, making advancements in plowing, all kinds of stuff.
They learned that from the monasteries?
Well, here's the thing: what comes out of the? You bring together these monasteries, okay, and it's not just monks, but you've got lay people, you've got blacksmiths, you've got artisans who all come and start living around the monastery.
What year is you talking about right now?
Well, Patrick comes in around 433 to Ireland, and then onwards until 800.
Mm-hmm. But at that time, isn't the world really evolved as far as people live, in, like you said, in small villages in the rural country?
Mm-hmm.
There was nothing, so they... the strongest one, the strongest one said, "You do this, you know, like I'm your master."
Yeah.
Was that time?
Well, that was what was going on in Europe, and.
But
Ireland was a bit different. See, this is the thing: we didn't learn it in school. That doesn't mean it didn't happen.
No.
But what's going on here? The Irish were they actually and Patrick would do this. He went after the kings. He would usually set up his churches or his religious centers near the towns of the kings. That was one of the first things he did. Then later they started getting these monasteries built out in the middle of nowhere and stuff. But he went over and he was confronting the kings all the time. You know, and he'd smack them down. He'd get them into line. He'd convert them and then focus on them, get the leadership, and the population is going to follow. But then it was the monks that were actually establishing the legal codes. That was one important thing that they did. And it was like a system of natural law that the kings were also subordinate to the law codes that the monks were establishing over time. The idea of these centers was learning and progress, right? And the cities of probably a lot of the modern cities in Ireland and major centers started as monasteries. So these were places of refuge for the population. They were protected there, and you'd have walled. I'll show actually a couple of pictures. Now, not all of them were conducive to farming, as you'll see. I mean, you know, not going to do much farming on the side of a cliff. But not all of them were like this. But these are a few places where they would... Cause, you know, some of the monks, they would get a little bit crazy. Like, there's a story of this one guy, Kevin, who went in the middle of nowhere, found a good cold lake. And he would just stand in the lake and recite prayers all day. And he lived in a little 3x4x7 foot, you know, cave in the side of a hill. He just wanted to be left alone. But eventually he started attracting other people who were coming to, you know, be taught by him. And he's a little bit annoyed by that because there wasn't enough space in the cave. He allowed his followers to end up building him a little monastery and became a fairly important site. I can't remember the name of it, but you get these kind of crazy stories and everything, right? But that's how these things would start.
Did they have any some of these places? The outside monasteries.
No, that's the thing. Not at the time. Eventually they do, but that comes later. Here you can see some of the. They would build these. This is where the monks would live. This is a kind of neat little engineering feat. There's nothing holding these stones together. They're just piled. It's the way they're piled at these beehives. And I have an interesting picture of this here from the air. You can see how the layout there. There's one little beehive, I guess, the old church, other buildings.
The walls are great.
The walls, yeah. So that's... And then, you know, they would be farming the fields all around. That'd be the idea. Then, you know, you'd get other settlement, you know, buildings being set up in all around as people congregated there because this is the center of economic activity, it was the center of intellectual and cultural activity in Ireland. And at a certain point, I think this is, say in the early 500s, you've got 20,000 monks and nuns in Ireland. And you've got another 20,000 Irish who are living around the monasteries. Out of a population of 250 to 300,000 people. So this is and all of these people were being educated. Now you think of the throughput that's going on, and you've got an enormous concentration of literacy. Because what you would learn Latin, you'd learn Greek, you'd also learn vernacular. They were the first written vernacular. It was Irish. The second was Welsh.
Wait, what does that mean?
Like English. See, at the time you had the languages of communication and intellectual activity were Greek and Latin. So that's what most people in Europe would have been speaking, in the Mediterranean world, the Roman world. So the vernacular is the local dialect, the local language. But only Greek and Latin at the time were written languages. But the Irish monks developed a form of writing for their own vernacular.
But Gaelic before that, with the myths and the legends, were they written down or
no,
transmitted orally?
No, transmitted orally.
Okay.
Yeah, they were then written down by the monks. And, there's this this one, you know, really funny, let's see if I can find it, because when they would start to write down these monks, they at least, you know, they were good enough that they wouldn't try to change things, because you know that you get a certain righteousness, you know, from the scribes, these monks who were writing down these stories, you know, these pagan stories, right? And saying, oh my God, you know, so like we have to change this, right? Because we can't allow people to actually read this stuff. But he, yeah, here it is here. It's kind of funny. It gives you a character, the people that are writing this stuff. So in the Book of Leinster, the given monastery, which contains a florid version of the Tane, the epic ends with a monastic amen, after which the scribe wrote down in Irish the earlier oral culture's bardic formula. A blessing on everyone who will memorize the Tane faithfully in this form and not put any other form on it. Just after this, in Latin, the same scribe left this succinct critique. I, who have copied down this story, or more accurately, fantasy, do not credit the details of the story or fantasy. Some things in it are devilish lies, and some are poetical figments. Some seem possible, and others not. Some are for the enjoyment of idiots.
It was like an introduction to the English.
No, that's at the end.
This guy is lucid.
So I'm not going to change this, but I'm going to tell you what I think. Because they recognize the importance, I think, of... I'm not going to judge whoever reads this, but I'm going to tell them what I think. So this is what was going on. But you know, they were learning everything. They were learning the classics. They were the whole bit. You know, Euclid, Homer, Virgil. You know, the Latin poets. This kind of stuff. Like they were. It was a serious curriculum. You would memorize the Psalms. 150 of them, that was one thing. I think it's 150. These kinds of things. So it was a very rigorous classical education, humanist education that they were getting. And as they, and also over time, as the word of what was going on in Ireland spread, you would get a lot of the intellectuals in Europe taking off for Ireland. And they would bring any books they had with them or knowledge. So you'd have new texts always being introduced into the culture, which would then be integrated into the educational system. So it was very interesting. And now, one of the things, though, with the education and the learning, is that if you read, you wrote, and you copied out the books that you were reading. So, you know, so every monastery was a school, but the schools were also scriptoria. That is, they were centers of transcription. So you had this massive production of books by these Irish monks. They, you know, they would do this stuff all the time. They loved it, you know, into the deep hours of the night. They'd be, you know, go out and sit under a tree and write out, you know, these stories. And, you know, it's, there's a funny story about one of these. Well, actually, before I get to that, I'll show you a couple of pictures. Because now, they weren't just, like, writing things out. This is not just scribbling down some notes or anything. But this actually became a vital philosophical question for the Irish, because they would ask, well, what is a letter? What does it mean to write a letter? And what it eventually came to was some of the most beautiful writing in all history. Now, this is a very famous page from a book called The Book of Kells. And the monasteries, the special books or compendiums of whether it's the Gospels or the Psalms or different things would come to be known by the name of the monastery from which they originated. Now this is known as the Chi Rho page because of the Greek letters Chi here, or X, and what looks like a P is actually a Greek R or Rho. So it represents the first three letters of Christ's name, CHR. And but if you look closer, though, it's hard to see here. If you start to investigate, you'll find there's all kinds of things going on in here. You'll find little forest creatures, and there'll be There's all kinds of stuff. I think I have a couple other close-ups of that are clear. This is of the four the symbols for the saints, or the four Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John.
Are these in manuscripts? Or?
Yeah. These are the. I think these are mostly from the Book of Cowles. But now imagine this is all done out by hand. It's all ink, and it's written on. Well, this is probably on vellum or calfskin, so it's dried calfskin is what it's traced on. And they actually invented the book, the actual book format. They did away with scrolls, which had been in the classical world, and they started using. They would get these sheets of normally sheepskin, and then they would fold them together into booklets. And then for the more important works, they would actually construct they'd bind them and things like that. So it was much easier to work with them.
But they didn't actually have paper. That
the Europe.
Well, this was the version of paper. Yeah.
Okay, the calf paper, the calf.
The skin. Yeah,
okay.
That's what they. Now here you can see this is a one letter. I don't know how large this was on the page, but you can see that the end of the letter is a little, like a an animal or something that's eating, a snake of some sort. But you know,
oh my God, that's a fish.
Or a fish, or whatever. But it, you know, you get all kinds of stuff like that all through them. Or you know, here on a page, you've got all kinds of stuff going on also on the part of the page. So it's kind of funny. And just to give you an idea, there's a story because two of the two most important. People who follow Patrick are, now this can get confusing, but St. Columba and St. Columban.
Columba and Columban.
Yeah.
Massive head.
Okay, this is, that's Columba and this is Columban.
What years are we
in? Okay, well, I wrote that down. Columba is born around 520 or 530 and dies in 597. And Columban is born in 540 and lives until 615.
Both in Ireland?
Yeah, both. They're both Irish. And they, they're really the spirit, the true inheritors of Patrick's legacy. And I'll tell you why in a minute. But there's something funny about Columba, because just to understand the importance of books to the Irish, the books were not just books, they were books.
Yeah.
All right. And it wasn't just the Irish that were like this. Also, in the Islamic world, you know, you'd get, you know, I think it was people like Harun al-Rashid. Some of these leaders, you know, when they would go and fight a battle against a Byzantine city or something, when the city would capitulate, they would ask for all the books, or you know, they'd exchange prisoners for books and things like that, because they were just so hard to come by. But St. Columba, as a young man, he was a kind of a fiery character too, and he ends up in one of the major monasteries. Oh yeah, and by the way, three of the biggest monasteries had anywhere from 3,000 to 4,000 monks. Huge. That's it. That's huge. So
cities in
monasteries. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they would, you know, and they would go out and they would reclaim the land. They would take land from kings that nobody was using, and they would, they would turn it into.
It's interesting that they would probably be the first cities not built either on purely economic reasons, like a mercantile city,
mm-hmm.
or political as a kingdom
mm-hmm.
or a castle. They would build for another purpose.
Well, you see the whole. It's a print. They're expressing a principle really that. That wealth is a function of the application of human labor. You know, that the productivity of the land is derived from the productivity of human labor applied to it. You know, you make the land more productive. So
there wasn't actually money involved in it. There was no money being traded between the monasteries.
Well, apparently some of the monasteries would mint coins for exchange. I'm sure they had some kind of
exchange system.
Rudimentary system, yeah. Maybe a lot of barter, but I think a lot of it was collective also, especially with the monasteries. But Columba, he ends up with, I think it's a guy named, I wrote down the name, right, Bishop Fenian of Clonard. And I think Clonard is, I might have to go back a couple of pages here, just to point out a couple of the major ones. Yeah, you've got, it's hard to, it's very difficult to see, yeah, you can barely even read them. Anyway, Armagh, that was Patrick's center, right there. And Bangor here had, I think, 3,000 or 4,000 monks. And one of the other big ones, Clonard, was somewhere around here. I think maybe there, also very, very large. But that's where Columba was, under this Bishop Fenian. And Bishop Fenian had a really nice book. And Columba wanted to make his own copy.
What, like that he, it was his book that he wrote?
Yeah, I guess that he'd written it out, so it was, you know, it was
not
his.
I mean, was he the author of the book? Or?
No, it was a book of, it would, you know, include the Gospels, the Psalms, maybe different Latin texts. It would be like anthologies of different works. I think that seems to be what, I mean, you get all kinds of different stuff, you know, whatever you could fit in there. You just copied everything you got your hands on.
They were handwritten.
Handwritten, yeah. So you can imagine, I mean, the amount of training involved for this stylization and to really do that. And it's funny, too, because the monks would write little scribbles in the their own little notes, like this guy at the end of the Tain. And the Cahill quotes some of them, and it'll be like, oh, man, I hate, you know, it. You know, I, boy, it's so obvious this is Frank's, you know, transcription. Or
glassing each other.
This kind of thing, you know.
The philosophy they have about letters, right? They wrote them in a special form.
Yeah, it's aesthetics,
yeah.
Right? They have this aesthetic sensibility about it, that it's clear it means more to them than just, it's not just words, but it's a question of beauty, and it's also an expression of, you know, this newfound understanding of their own nature. That's what they want to.
But I have a question about the calligraphy. So
mm-hmm.
all those ornate letters that we see.
Yeah.
Now, is it systemic? Is it... is it dictator, or is that just people deciding, well, I'm going to put a fish in this letter and I'm going to put a snake in that one, or do we see repetition, so we see a system that these letters are always drawn this way?
Well, I think there's a lot, I don't think it's a systematized like that. I think certain things are with it, they have a shorthand for some of the different pictures I've seen. You'll have the Latin lines in a very clear, specific, they did develop a particular script that became, I think, it seems to be fairly predominant. You would then also have a particular Gaelic script that they would adhere to. But with the more stylized stuff, I think that's personal touches. You know, like, I forget the word, you know, the, yeah, that's their own little touches.
Yeah? Were women...
Actually, yeah, this is one of the interesting things, is you had women abbesses. I mean, that would have been totally, that would have freaked out the Catholics. An abbot is the head of a monastery. So you had women also heading monasteries. Some were very important.
An abbot?
Yeah, I think. So... yeah, you had it was a very very open culture, to and women could get educated just as men could. It was open to everybody. So Columba wants to transcribe this book, but he's not allowed for whatever reason. So he wants to do it in secret, and so what he does is he'll take the book at night, and you know, again, like these Irish legends, right? He apparently was writing out the book in complete darkness. He had no candles or anything like that, because he didn't want to get caught. But the fingers of his left hand shone on the page, and that allowed him to write out the text.
Yeah. This is awesome.
That's a miracle.
You could have
miracle.
This if it was real. That's got to be real.
But anyway, he got caught. And, he got caught. Maybe because of the fingers, yeah. And so
they illuminated the wrong tire.
So the
like
cage
just like sitting there. Oh.
So he goes before the local king, a guy named King Diarmate, and the king rules. I guess this famous line: "For every cow her calf, for every book its copy." So, yeah. So basically, the first copyright law imposed. So he said you can't copy it out. So anyway, that was a big big problem for Columba. Columba was pretty upset about that.
It was a manuscript of what?
Well, Columba was trying to copy out the book of his bishop.